In the preface to his History of Rome, Livy wrote that he wanted to explore, quote, what was the life, what the mores, by what men, and by what arts, at home and at war, imperium was born and augmented, close quote. This is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz, your host for this, the After Dinner Scholar podcast from Wyoming Catholic College. Those questions, what was the life, what the mores, by what men, by what arts, are not just questions limited to our understanding of ancient Rome. They're questions for every era and for every people. In the course, Exodus and the American Vision, what was the life, what the mores, what the men, and by what arts are questions that Dr. Pavlos Papadopoulos' senior humanities students are asking with the help of authors, including John Adams, Edmund Burke, Thomas Jefferson, and others. I asked Dr. Papadopoulos to tell us about the inspiration for his course.
At the beginning of his History of Ancient Rome, Livy says that he is interested in studying the early days of Rome. He wants to know what the life was, what the mores or customs, by what men and by what arts at home and abroad, imperium was born and augmented in Rome. Livy wants to know what the ancient Romans were like and how Rome became great, the great power that it was in his time in the first place. I think this is a helpful way to approach our ancestors, our forebears in early America. And this course, being a humanities course, addresses this question, what are Americans like? What is America like? Through a number of different kinds of texts. We read historical and political texts, and we also read literary texts. So far, with the seniors in this class, we've read some Alexis de Tocqueville, Democracy in America. We've read Mark Twain's Huckleberry Finn. We've read a collection of founding documents, including the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. And we are working our way currently through the Federalist Papers, all with an eye to trying to understand what the nature of the American soul is and what the nature of American community is.
Now, why Exodus and the American experience?
Because that is the image that Americans from their very earliest settlements at Plymouth, at Provincetown, understood themselves with reference to. As Tocqueville quotes the early Puritan settlers in Massachusetts as saying that they are out on an errand into the wilderness, just as the chosen people are escaping Egypt and going into the wilderness, following God to the promised land. So there's this great question. That's the frame of the Massachusetts colonies, is that they will try to build a city upon a hill, leave England, leave Europe, and find a place where they're able to worship God freely and live freely, governing themselves and one another according to the dictates of their conscience.
Now, the quote from Livy about life, mores, what men, what arts, is that what we mean by a people's spirit?
I think so. Yeah, there's a few different ways of thinking about that. But yes, that's fair. What are the not only the beliefs that an American would say, here is what I believe, but also the whole character of American individuals and the way they're ordered together in American society that would make them act upon those beliefs. So a helpful way of thinking about this is the transition between the first paragraph of the Declaration of Independence and the second. The first paragraph of the Declaration of Independence says that under these circumstances, when a people must dissolve the political bands which have connected them to another, they should, a decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they declare the causes which impel them to the separation. The very next thing that the Declaration says is we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, and so on. In other words, the first cause of the American people acting in the way that they did in 1776 was not some external stimulus, was not the king or parliament mistreating them. The deepest cause is that we are the kind of people who hold these truths to be self-evident. So there's that intellectual side of here is the American creed or here are the American's first principles for political action. but it's embodied in us. We, the people, the American people, we hold these truths to be self-evident. So what we're trying to do is see both the ideas, but not merely the ideas, also how they are embodied in Americans as they lived, as they imagined themselves, and the stories they told themselves. And that goes back to that Exodus frame that the early Americans had for seeing themselves as a kind of new Israel, crossing through the wilderness and trying to find the promised land and live there according to God's law.
Now, what are some of the characteristics of that spirit?
Right. What is spirit? Spiritedness, if we go back to Plato, spiritedness is that part of the soul that binds together the higher and the lower, that subordinates the appetites to the intellect. And it appears in self-assertiveness and in the ability not only to rule over oneself, but to demand as an individual, and therefore to conform oneself to virtue, but also to try to rule over oneself as a community and resist invasions upon one's people by outsiders. There's a great speech that Edmund Burke, the great British statesman and philosopher, made to Parliament in March 1775, just a month or so before the Battle of Lexington and Concord, where he urged Parliament to conciliate with the colonists. He said, essentially, that these are a very high-spirited people. These are a very thumotic people, if we take Plato's term. And we have been mistreating them. We, the British, have been mistreating them. And if we continue to mistreat them, they will act not as a slavish people would, which is to accept our mistreatment, but as a high-spirited people would, which is to continue to resist, even maybe to the point of rebellion or independence. There's another wonderful document about early America that I've read with my students. This is actually from a late 19th century historian, Mellon Chamberlain, but he recalls interviewing a veteran from the Battle of Lexington and Concord. And he asks the man, Captain Preston, why did you go to the Concord fight in April 1775? And the historian who's interviewing him said, "I've heard from history that you men of the Revolution took up arms against intolerable oppressions." And Captain Preston said, "I didn't experience any oppressions." "Well, what about the Stamp Act?" "Well, I never paid a penny for any of those stamps." "What about the tea tax?" Captain Preston said, "The boys threw it all overboard. We never drank a drop of that tea." "Well, I suppose you've been reading Harrington and Sidney and Locke about the eternal principles of liberty." In other words, I suppose you had learned something of modern political philosophy and you saw that the situation in front of you was an instance of liberty. And Captain Preston's answer is, "Never heard of them. We only read the Bible, the Catechism, Watts Psalms and Hymns, and the Almanac." The historian asks, what was the matter? What did you mean in going to the fight?" And Captain Preston answers, "What we meant in going for those red coats was this. We always had governed ourselves, and we always meant to. They didn't mean we should." And the historian comments that this is the ultimate philosophy of the American Revolution, that the attitude of the colonists was not that of slaves seeking liberty, but of free men for five generations, resisting political servitude. So there's this long-standing custom and habit and institutions supporting a certain pattern of soul in early America of self-governance, of just the practice of being neglected by the British and of carrying those customs and laws from Britain to America that support a way of life where people are living in a small community, in a town, and then in a state that they have organized themselves politically, and they can rule over themselves, and they resent being ruled by what is perceived to be a foreign element without their consent.
In one of the other documents, you had a letter written by John Adams dated January 15th, 1783, kind of anticipating de Tocqueville, don't you think? He talks about four institutions produced by the Revolution: towns, churches, schools, and local militia. What do these tell us about the early Republic and the character of the American people?
So Adams is writing to a Frenchman, the Abbé de Mably, telling him, if you want to understand the origin of the American Revolution, these are the institutions you need to understand. These were the governing institutions in Massachusetts in particular, and they spread, at least sometimes they were reproduced in other colonies, but in other ways just their spirit spread throughout all the colonies. And in each case, this is where the public decisions were made by the Americans, and the first determinations to resist in arms were made. Both the mind and the spirit of the American people were formed in these institutions. The towns give Americans the habit of self-government. He says it was in these town meetings that the sentiments of the people were first formed and their resolutions taken from the beginning to the end of this controversy and war. Americans have the habit of deliberating among themselves, instructing their representatives, and making all kinds of provisions for themselves, providing for their own well-being and self-governance on a very local level. And that gave them, when the crisis came, the habit of meeting together to try to think through and resolve together and then act upon their resolution of the crisis that was coming down on them from Great Britain. The churches are organized locally as well. These are, of course, primarily Protestant churches throughout Massachusetts. And Adams mentions the very, very high expectation for moral rectitude that the townspeople have for their clergy, and how they will expel their clergy if they fail in their vocation or if they fail in their moral character. The preachers in their various towns are also, he says, very popular, zealous friends of liberty. In other words, this democratic spirit pervades even American religious affairs as well as political affairs. Adams' comments about the schools are quite interesting to me. He mentions that Massachusetts law requires every town to maintain a schoolhouse and to pay a teacher who will teach reading, writing, arithmetic, and the rudiments of Latin and Greek. In other words, just the fundamentals of education simply, and even of classical education. And these public schools spread throughout the state are offered to all, poor and rich alike. So it's really a preparation for everyone to be a member of society. And it's clear that there's a political or civic dimension to them in what he says about their relation to the colleges. He says there are these colleges spread throughout New England, and the best students go from the town schools to the colleges. And he says in those colleges are educated masters for the schools, ministers for the churches, practitioners in law and physic or medicine, and magistrates and officers for the government of the country. In other words, the colleges who take the most intellectually advanced students from all of the public schools in the colony provide for the material and spiritual well-being of the colony. They're actually directed towards a public purpose, both political and transpolitical. Schoolmasters to continue the education of the young, church ministers to look after the spiritual well-being of the people, lawyers, doctors, and politicians, again, to minister to the physical, individually and communal, the physical good and the spiritual good of the whole people. And then finally, the militia, he says, comprehends the whole people. Every male inhabitant between 16 and 60 is enrolled in the militia, and they are required to keep at his own expense a gun, a firelock, a powder horn and a pound of powder, 12 flints, 4 and 20 bullets, a cartouche box and a haversack, so that the whole country is ready to march for their defense at a short warning. The militia comprehends the whole people, or the whole able-bodied male part of the population. And it's as if you see the whole country marching whenever the militia is called. It's not a specialized professional military. It's not a volunteer military. It's understood to be part of citizenship, that you are armed and organized, that you're a well-regulated militia, and that you're ready to march on behalf of the whole country to secure its common good. He concludes his letter by saying, "Thus, sir, you have a brief sketch of the four principal sources of that wisdom and counsel and skill and bravery in war, which have produced the American Revolution, which I hope will be sacredly preserved as the foundations of a free, happy, and prosperous people." It's clear that Adams thinks you need to address both the causes of our wisdom and the causes of our skill and bravery in war, our spiritedness or our manliness, in order to understand how the Americans chose to revolt against Great Britain.
And it's interesting, of course, that he wrote that to a Frenchman, comparing the two revolutions then.
Yeah. It is, and it is of course, in still before the French Revolution has broken out, but he belongs through this letter to a great tradition of at least implicitly comparing the American regime and the French. And you can see the French interest in America even before the French Revolution breaks out. And of course, those go in very different directions.
Well, and that has something to do with the spirit of the people, doesn't it?
It does. I think Tocqueville's probably the best author to look to for this, both in his work, Democracy in America, which we read in this class, and his other great work, The Old Regime and the Revolution, which we do not. But it's it's clear in Tocqueville's view that the American, especially the local level of self-government that the Americans have, that they have as a habit for generations upon generations, makes a huge deal of difference in how they then conduct their revolution. Tocqueville has famous remarks in Democracy in America about centralization of administration and centralization of government, and how the French have over-centralized their governance going back to the early 18th century, even under the monarchy. And then in his other work, The Old Regime and the Revolution, he has some wonderful observations about the way in which French intellectuals relate to politics. And it's because the French are so used to having all power concentrated at the center that the great class of French intellectuals are alienated from politics and don't have practice with politics. As a result, they're more susceptible to kind of radical theorizing that is not at all tempered by practice. And Tocqueville contrasts that with the British experience, and I think we could say by extension the American experience, where men of letters are constantly involved in politics as well as theorizing. And as a result, their theorizing does not become so wild and abstract as the French philosophes.
Now, as our students study this history, how does that impact them? How does it make them better human beings and better citizens? Or does it?
I hope it does. We'll have to wait and see. But I hope to be laying the foundation for that. And that's what the philosophical vision statement of our college concludes with, that we are trying to make our students into better men and women. And as a result of that, our hope will be that they will also become better citizens, because the quality of a political regime is determined by the quality of its citizens. So education and trying to address the virtues and habits of students is in an indirect way trying to address the quality of the political regime in general. What I hope our students see in reading about the early Americans, and especially in being called to look at their spirited character, their self-assertive character, is not that they will become reckless in their self-assertion, but that they'll be able to have that education of the chest, as C.S. Lewis calls it in The Abolition of Man, the education of the chest, the seat of stable sentiments, and that spirited character that is required for directing oneself and then pursuing zealously what one sees as right. The American founding documents always make this note about prudence in the Declaration of Independence. Prudence will dictate governments long established should not be changed for light and transient causes. So the spiritedness that would cause you to react against and lash out at what you perceive to be even a tyrannical measure needs to be tempered by prudence, because if you react in that way to every slight against you, you would soon destroy all the conditions for good life in your political order. Nevertheless, knowing the right principles alone is insufficient. We are not mere minds, but we are embodied persons with minds as well as chests or hearts, as well as desires or stomachs. And so if we are to educate the whole person, we should understand not only the ideas of the Americans that we still have in some way today, but also the character that is required to embody those ideas, the character, the quality of spirit that is required to make these ideas articulated in our founding documents, to make them into a reality, to make them actionable, to make them the basis for an entire way of life.
Writing to his wife, Martha, from Paris, Thomas Jefferson said, quote, "It is part of the American character to consider nothing as desperate, to surmount every difficulty by resolution and contrivance," close quote. Oddly enough, the difficulty Martha was experiencing had to do with reading Livy. Nonetheless, what he told her to apply to her reading applies well beyond the difficulties of the studious. The American character that Jefferson observed was forward-thinking, creative, resolute, and optimistic, qualities we hope to build into our Wyoming Catholic College graduates, and that we pray would be common among our citizens. For Wyoming Catholic College, this is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz.